Hello, Radioland Podcastville and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books. Today on our show, Andy Bowers is here. He's the Chief Content Officer of the Panoply Network of Podcasts, and he has kindly agreed to tell us how bad we are. Joining me are my usual co-hosts. She is the LARB fiction editor, among many other roles in life, Lori Weiner. Hello, Lori.
Woo! That means I'm excited to be here.
Oh, I'm excited to be here too, because Tom Lutz is here. Hello, Tom.
Seth, how are you?
I'm good. Andy Bowers is here today. He is the Chief Content Officer at Panoply Media, a division of Slate Group. Welcome, Andy, to the LARB Radio Hour.
Thank you for having me. I really, I love LARB, and it's an honor to be here.
What is the Panoply Network?
The Panoply Network is an umbrella network for a variety of mostly media organizations and authors who want to do podcasts. It grew out of my work for the last 10 years at Slate doing podcasts for that online magazine. My background is from NPR. I joined Slate to work on radio projects, and then when podcasting came along, I was like, oh, okay, a part of the internet I actually understand. We can start doing this. And it turned out that Slate was filled with good talkers, people who like to hear themselves talk, but who actually are interesting to listen to as well. So we put together a portfolio of podcasts, about 10 to 15, depending on what year it was. And we discovered that it brought a literal voice to the magazine, which is always said to have a voice. But here were the voices of the people who put it together. You could hear them coming up with story ideas on the shows.
I want to ask specifically about their voices. I'm a fan of several of the podcasts you do at Slate.
Thank you. Particularly
the Cultural Gabfest and the Political Gabfest. And when I started listening to them, I marveled at the quality of the hosts. They all sounded like broadcast people. And as far as I know, none of them had a background in broadcasting.
That's right.
And I want to know, did you get them coaching? Or were they just naturals? How did that happen?
Basically, they were naturals. I tried to put together groupings of people who I thought would be good together. I wanted a couple of things. I wanted people who liked each other but liked to spar with each other. We like to say a good podcast needs a Simon Cowell. Do one of you want to take the mantle on this podcast?
I think that's Seth.
I think that would be me.
I'm the drunk girl. What's her name?
Paula Abdul.
You need some conflict.
Right. And we have found that one of our problems is that we often agree about everything.
That is a problem.
Then we just decide not to do that show.
Yes. Our flagship show, The Political Gabfest, with David Plotz, who was the editor of Slate when we started doing it, he kind of took on that Simon Cowell role instinctively. He knew that even if he agreed with the other two, he should take the devil's advocate position and make them defend their position and argue. And sometimes he would change their minds. And so that is one piece of advice I would give you. It's fun to do. Right. Listeners like it. You know,
Seth, you ignorant slut.
There you go.
Like that, right?
As we learned years ago. Panoply Network also includes our friend Karina Longworth, who we like and who we interviewed for the show. What constitutes a person who would be in the Panoply Network, and can we get in it?
Well, I'd be happy to talk to you about that. Let me give you my card. Panoply Network, we decided that there were a lot of organizations that we thought, given the higher profile of podcasting last year, we figured other organizations would want to get into it, but it's a specialized thing to do. You need microphones like these. You need special rooms. So we figured there would be a market for services we could provide. We could provide expertise. We could provide ad sales, which is important. It's a different kind of ad sales than anything else on the internet or even radio.
Can you talk a little more about the sales, which you say is unique to this situation?
Mm-hmm. At first, I think we at Slate were approaching it as similar to digital text sales, banner ads, things like that, going to the same people. But very quickly, we and a few other podcasters discovered that the most effective kind of ads and the ones that listeners preferred were kind of back to the future, 50s style hosts talking about the product. You know, I never
GE Electric you know, is sponsoring what, you know, Edward Murrow or whatever.
Something like that. Yeah. But, you know, it's Harry's Razors.
You know, this would be a very good time to tell you that I am now a user of Harry's Razors.
Are you?
I am. It works, apparently.
Did you use our promo code?
I did use the promo code. I think I saved $5.
Well, and you see, because of those promo codes, that's why we know this works, because these are direct response advertisers, a lot of them. They give you a special code for each show, and they can tell how many people are buying the product through that. The advertising works uniquely well, and also it's mobile, which most advertisers have been unable to get. These teeny little things that you see on phone screens, those little banner ads, those don't work at all. No one sees them. This is a primarily mobile medium, and people are actually listening to the ads.
Other than the mobility, though, Andy, do you think podcasting is fundamentally different from radio?
Yes, I do. I didn't at first. I thought they were siblings, and now I think they're not that close cousins. I can go into why if you're
interested. Yeah,
well, first of all, it can succeed with much smaller audiences. It doesn't have to go the lowest common denominator or even, you know, NPR style medium common denominator. But, you know, NPR still has to be very careful. They can't piss off large portions of their audience. We can. We can put out podcasts that most people will hate, but some people will absolutely love. And that is really important. They are the most engaged audience I've ever seen. They feel like they have joined a club by opting into this thing. And when they meet someone else who listens to the same show, they're like, "Oh, yes, right. We're part of that club together." It also obviously doesn't involve time limits, and radio, for better or worse, has to deal with those all the time. I worked for NPR for 20 years. If we had 3 hours of material for Morning Edition, we had a two-hour time slot. If we had 1 hour of material, we had a two-hour time slot. We had to fill that. Podcasting doesn't have to do that. But it's also allowing for experimentation that is impossible when you have a limited number of broadcast hours. For example, audio drama. This is something that I wanted to bring to public radio all the time I was there because I've loved it since I was a kid. It got no traction whatsoever. Just in the last few months, we produced a show called The Message, which was an 8-part science fiction serialized drama. We produced it with GE, also an old-fashioned style thing. They wanted to go back to GE theater like they did in the 50s. And so they sponsored this without any advertising at all. They just said, "We want to do a cool story." And it became the number one podcast in America for a few weeks. I could not believe it.
And Serial, of course, and these kinds of shows that are narrative, these things are helping bring that back, it seems to me.
Serial is a great example of the difference because, you know, it comes from This American Life. It feels like This American Life, and yet it felt different also. And people are still listening. The number one downloaded show is still Serial. People are discovering it right now. And you can't do that on the radio. You know, you miss it if you don't catch it
when
it's on.
What we need is a good murder to get our numbers up.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at the pretty young assistants.
Aviva, I'm sorry.
It would be worth it, right, Aviva?
We would immortalize you.
Laura Palmer for the podcasting world.
And you have a great radio voice.
Well, you're very kind.
Did you grow up with that voice? Were you talking like that when you were a kid, or have you kind of trained yourself to speak in a particular way for the radio?
Well, first of all, thank you. I never got formal training for it, but I knew from the time I was in high school here in Santa Monica, as a matter of fact, I knew not only what company I wanted to work for, but what job I wanted there. I wanted to be the London bureau chief at NPR. And so the moment I got to college, I started doing radio. I got internships at NPR the second I could possibly do it. And I worked my way single-mindedly toward that. And I suspect that through my mind, I was thinking, I need to sound like someone on the radio.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I listen to somebody like Kai Rizdahl, and I think, I want to talk like that. I want to figure it out. And I listen to him wondering if he's doing it on purpose. Or if now it's just become a completely natural thing for him.
I would guess it has become natural.
But we're halfway there because we have faces for radio. So now we just have to do the voices.
But this is also something about podcasting is the typical radio voice is slightly dying out. I mean, not a lot of people on podcasts sound that way, and I think that's an advantage.
It sounds phony. It's like you listen to T.S. Eliot read his poetry, and, you know, that sounded good
Let
in 19...
Let us go now, you and I.
No, that's Michael Silverblatt reading T.S. Eliot.
Well, thanks so much for coming in, Andy, and telling us how to do it.
Oh, my pleasure.
We really appreciate it.
I'll be listening and sending notes.
Great.
Andy Bowers, the head of the Panoply Network of the Slate Group. This is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner. You're listening to the LARB Radio Hour, 90.7 KPFK FM. The man who preceded us in these chairs, although he only sat in one because there was only one Colin Marshall, the originator of the LARB podcast, is back with us through the miracle of technology, although he's actually in South Korea right now. Before Colin left, he collated a bunch of his favorite interviews for us. And today we're going to play one that he did with Dana Goodyear.
Colin, do you want to set this up for us?
Oh, Colin is a hologram, I should just say. Go ahead.
This is a conversation about a book Dana Goodyear, who is a New Yorker correspondent, wrote called Anything That Moves, about modern eating culture in the 21st century, focused very much on Los Angeles. She lives over in Venice. I went to visit her there to talk about this book. And the book is well known among Los Angeles food people because a lot of it's based on interactions, conversations with Jonathan Gold, a name that for many needs no introduction because he's been writing about food in Los Angeles for decades and decades. He gets to things that he seems to be the only one who knows about. He knows what it means to eat in Los Angeles, what it means to cover the ground of Los Angeles, what it means to explore Los Angeles through food, which to my mind is one of the main ways to explore it. And that's what Dana learned. And that's what I wanted to know from her. What specifically did you learn from Jonathan Gold? And what did he teach you to do in terms of understanding Los Angeles?
I got here in 2005, and almost immediately, you know, people that I was meeting would suggest outings, and instead of let's meet for coffee, it was let's go out to the San Gabriel Valley, where, you know, Jonathan Gold has reviewed this place out there. And I found this really, really interesting that he was a guide to the city, almost, you know, more meaningful than the Thomas guide. He was a map maker for people, and he encouraged people to get out of their neighborhoods and into places of unfamiliarity and discomfort even, and to eat things that also were a little bit uncomfortable often, and that a kind of social life and entertainment could be found in trying foods that challenged your, you know, your sense of what was delicious and edible. But he's also started to tell an alternative story about LA that is not the LA of the Peninsula Hotel and plastic surgery and, you know, people having grapes dandled into their mouths by underlings. I mean, the sort of power LA story that a lot of the literature of LA reflects is not really to be found in Jonathan Gold's writing, except in very sneaky and subversive ways.
And in many senses, his is the majority of Los Angeles, right? The guy on a bus on Pico Boulevard is... There's more of him than there are of the Peninsula Hotel grape danglers, right?
It's the lived experience. It's the Angelino's experience of L.A. And I think a lot of the power L.A. story is told by visitors. And it's usually the accumulated first impressions and doesn't really penetrate much deeper. And this is a city that can feel very superficial to a visitor. And one of the things that Gold has done is to deepen the residence experience of the city, but also, you know, he's become the guide either in person or through his writing for hundreds, I can say probably thousands of New York magazine editors visiting LA and wanting to experience something of it. That there's a sort of intuition you have as an outsider, a person visiting LA, that there's more going on, but you can't find it exactly, and so you end up feeling frustrated and blaming it on the traffic and going home.
Yes. Oh, these people, the city.
Yeah, but he's...
You call this a bagel?
He has allowed for a different... He sort of opened the door for a different story to be told about the city, I think.
I think that's true. I think that in New York, New Yorkers have a map of the city in their mind, and they don't want anybody telling them about their map of the city. And here, it's like we've kind of thrown up our hands, and it's like, please tell me about my city that I live in. But also, Jonathan is a friend of mine, and I have to say that, you know, I've had many, many meals with him. And the thing that impresses me the most about him is that he never takes a note, ever.
That is impressive.
How does he remember, you know, what he tasted on his tongue and where? And, you know, it's just, it's incredible.
That's a superpower.
Yeah,
it really is. And he says that it's not just a prodigious memory, that he can't remember, you know, whether he put socks on or not, but he can remember whether a soup he had in 1984 in a little town in France had chervil or parsley on it.
That's
true. Use what you got.
Now you've lived in Koreatown for a while.
Right. It's the only neighborhood I've lived in Los Angeles.
And you've also eaten Korean food in Korea.
Sure.
And so how did you find Jonathan's Koreatown recommendations? Is he on? Is he off?
I think he seems to know Koreatown well. He goes through bursts of... There's occasionally... Now, Laura, you know him, so you can clarify here, but I feel like the bursts of Jonathan Gold interest in Koreatown are periodic. We see a big production, you know, Jonathan Gold's 500 Koreatown recommendations every so often. It's not something he's always talking about, but when he's talking about it, he is.
Yeah, no, he does go through obsessions like most writers. One of my favorite stories is when he went through his coffee obsession, and he had 11 coffees in one day, and then he met his wife for dinner, and he said, please don't order such and such, and she ordered it, and then he burst into tears and had to leave and take the bus home because
these things happen.
You know, food is emotional. I mean, it had an effect on him.
And caffeine is real.
That was Colin Marshall talking about Dana Goodyear, talking about Jonathan Gold. If you want to check out what Colin is doing now, you can find him on the Korea blog on the LARB site, lareviewofbooks.org. This is Seth Greenland. I'm here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner. You're listening to the LARB Radio Hour, 90.7 KPFK FM.
Fear not, you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, and this is your humble producer, Jerry Gorin. I just want to note that the following segment, an interview with comedian Bonnie McFarlane, was taped in August of 2015, and without the presence of one of our hosts, Tom Lutz. So, just Seth, Laurie, and Bonnie McFarlane talking about Bonnie's new book, You're Better Than Me, coming out on February 23rd.
Our next guest is a comedian, a podcaster, and soon to be an author. Her book is called, a title I love, You're Better Than Me. Bonnie McFarlane, welcome to the LARB Radio Hour.
Thank you for having me. This is exciting.
We're excited to have you.
So you came to my attention because Lori said there's this fantastic podcast you have to listen to. And the podcast is called My Wife Hates Me?
My Wife Hates Me.
My Wife Hates Me. And I listened to it and I said to Lori, are they actors playing characters? Because those two people could not really be married, right? Isn't that, that's what I said to you, right?
Right. And then I said, remember, they're comedians.
Right. And so now that you're here, is that, how much is that a shtick? And are you still married to Rich?
Yes, I'm still married to Rich. Well, because we were going to do a podcast and that wasn't going to be the original name. And at the last minute, I snuck that name in there and everyone liked it except for Rich.
We should also say that let's plug your husband. Your husband is Rich Vos, the comedian.
Yes, that's right. That's how I told him that I hated him, was I just named the podcast that.
I think that's sensitive. And
yes.
Well done. Well handled.
Very passive aggressive. No, I mean, we have a very sort of weird relationship where we bust balls a lot. And then we do it on the podcast. And my best friend one time asked me, she goes, how much of this is real? She knows this really well. And I was like, I don't even know how much is real, really. I don't get what's going on sometimes, you know?
That's why it's so good. But it is interesting, you know, because comedians, truth tellers, busting balls. And then, of course, in marriage, that can be complicated.
Well, I have always... pretty much exclusively dated comedians. Once I got into the world of comedy, I didn't feel like talking to anybody else very much. So, well, because people will always say like, oh, you shouldn't date comedians if you're a comedian. But I just think anyone in any profession should date in the same profession, because otherwise you would have to talk about dentistry for half the time. Who wants to do that? Who wants to listen to the other person talk about their
I own? Actually find dentistry very interesting.
Oh, sorry. Yes. I mean, of course you do. You're teeth obsessed.
I am.
You know, we have no filters and no boundaries. So we would get in a fight. We get in fight in front of people, fights in front of people all the time where it's, you can see the look on their face. They get so uncomfortable, but we don't know how to stop. We watch in movies where someone will say something to their husband, you know, a pointed, and then the husband will say, you know, I don't appreciate you saying that. And then that's it. That's the end of the argument. We're like, how do they do that?
But as a comic married to one, and this is so inside baseball, but I'm fascinated by it. Do you fight over premises?
No. I mean, we have very distinct and different styles. However, sometimes if I think something might make the audience angry, I'll ask him to try it first because he's really fearless. And then lots of times I'll just be talking and he'll be like, I'm going to do that. And then he'll just do it.
You have a great story in your book. I loved your book.
Oh, thank you.
I thought it was so much fun. I read it yesterday and I just put me in a good mood.
It's the scariest thing I've ever done. It's so crazy that people are reading it. Ugh.
I know, but you're going to have to get used to that. There's one story. It's just a tiny little throwaway story, but you're about to go on stage, and this comedian says to you, "You know, what are you going to open with?" And you tell her or him your joke, and the comedian says, "Do not open with that. That is not going to work." And then the comedian takes the stage and uses that joke.
Yes.
Which is like incredibly
pretty much
weird.
Word for word as you know, I told
like
it.
Was that meant to be affectionate at all, or was that a complete fuck you?
That was a complete fuck you.
That was a comedian fuck you.
Because I was really new to New York. I had just met her. She was maybe not famous, but well known at the time. And I think she was doing it like, welcome to New York, you know, kind of. Here we go.
Yeah.
You're not on the farm anymore.
Yes.
And speaking of the farm, Bonnie grew up on a farm in Saskatchewan.
I was on the border of Alberta and Saskatchewan, but I went to school in Alberta. I mean, I consider myself an Albertan, if it matters to people.
No, that's a huge distinction.
Yes.
Now, Alberta is a well-known comedy factory, of course.
Yes, producing all kinds.
I'm really fascinated in by how people develop their sensibility. And how was it for you growing up on a farm in Alberta? It's just a rare thing for someone to go from there to being on the Letterman show. When did you realize you were funny? And what was it like being that kind of person in that kind of setting?
I guess I kind of always thought I was funny, but I just really had a hard time convincing the people around me. I mean, my parents, I think, thought I was pretty obnoxious a lot of the times. And my sister, but you know, this is the thing, is I just had a sort of different sense of humor. You know, people were pretty literal. I mean, most people really are very literal, and I'm not. I like, you know, sort of weird and quirky and silly stuff. And so I guess, I don't know, it just was always hard. They did like it when I would, like, you know, make fun of my teachers at school and that sort of thing. And our family dinners were a lot like a roast, where somebody would sort of just, I don't know how it would work out, but we'd all just start picking on one person. We really had a bully mentality in our house, but it was pretty funny. My dad's very witty and funny when he feels like doing it. So,
did you think you could be a comic? Was that something that was even on your radar?
No, I didn't know. I didn't even know what that was a thing until I was in high school. I really didn't have any idea that.
And they didn't have a TV.
We did not. Yeah. So. My friend had a George Carlin album that we listened to that I didn't understand. I didn't know what it was that I was listening to. And I think it was also stuff that I didn't have any idea actually what he was talking about. So it wasn't really, I always wanted to be a writer, and I always wrote when I was younger. And
you read also when you were.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff did you read when you were a kid?
Well, my mom, you know, has all kinds of books, but it's you know, like Stephen King and, sort of, you know, middle of the road, I guess, kind of stuff. But I read all of that. Anything. My mom would let us read anything we wanted. There was no. Mm-hmm. We read all the Judy Blume and all that stuff. You know.
Well, when did you realize that you wanted to write a book? I mean, yes, you were a writer and you're writing jokes and routines. How did you realize you wanted, was there something, I mean, how did you realize you wanted to write it? Who guided you and how did you find a publisher?
Well, I did a roast at the Food and Wine Festival, and I can't remember what year it was, but maybe 3 years ago. And Anthony Bourdain was the person we were roasting. It came to me late. They called me. I think, honestly, they couldn't find a woman, or the woman that they wanted. I think it might have been Amy Schumer, was out of town or whatever. And so they asked me if I would do it. And I'm a really good roast writer, and I write for people when they do roast on the Comedy Central roast and stuff like that. So that was like, you know, not a big deal for me to sit down and just write a bunch of jokes for all these people that I didn't know. It was, you know, all these like sort of TV chefs that were there, and then Artie Lang was there, and Jim Norton, the other comedians. And I guess because I felt like I had more to prove, I tried really hard. You know, I wrote really, for 2 days straight, just sweated it out. And when I got there, you know, everyone went on, I went on, and it was just great. It was, you know, it felt really good. And afterwards, Anthony Bourdain was really complimentary to me. And his agent, Kim Witherspoon, approached me and said, email me. So we went and had lunch, Anthony and Kim and I. And they just said, do you want to write a book? We think you should write a book. And the funny thing is Anthony said, or Tony, if you call him Tony, I still call him Anthony. He said, I've never met a woman who had that kind of voice before. But I was thinking, like, he thinks I just walk around roasting people all the time. So whenever I see him, I still feel like I have to be a little bit like, hey, nice shirt, buddy. You know? Like, I don't.
The book is You're Better Than Me. It was written by Bonnie McFarlane. Bonnie, thanks for coming in.
Thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks to Andy Bowers, Colin Marshall. Thanks to our producer and moral conscience, Jerry Gorin. Our production assistant, Ernesto Aureliano. Czarina of Scheduling, Aviva de Kornfeld. We couldn't do this show without the generosity of the Goldhirsch Foundation, and we would like to thank them. Find us on the web at www.lareviewofbooks.org. Download us on iTunes. Better yet, give us a rating. 5 stars is good. Lori, what do you think? Have we earned 5 stars lately?
Sid Biggs thinks we have.
What happened to Sid Biggs?
I know, you used to always thank Sid.
He was, well, he kind of didn't show up, and now he's not here.
Did he tell you why he wasn't here, or did he say anything? Just
not
left?
A, wow. Not a word. It's
that
a mystery.
That's hurtful. You know,
we
that's
might
hurtful.
We might have to resurrect the BJ Novak bit.
No, that's dead.
I think I think Sarah Koenig has Serial season 3. Where did Sid Biggs go?